Good afternoon. I'd like to call the committee to order. Thank you for everybody for showing up today. It's good to see everybody back. I hope that you're all staying warm and that you've had a little time off during the interim. And as we get into this, obviously we're not in session yet. We're not here to take any official action today, but I just thought I would give you just a little preview of what we're going to be doing this session. As most of you know, certainly if you've gotten my emails, we've got a really heavy agenda for this very, very short session. So one of the ways we're going to manage that is by having a committee omnibus bill. And for those of you who may not have been through this process before, at least in the policy committee, what that entails is hearing bills, and then rather than voting on them, many of them as they come through will be laying them over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The way this process works is that we hear the bills, we collect them, and then later on we will put together an omnibus bill, a proposed bill that will be presented to the committee. Then there will be an opportunity for the committee to draft amendments. We'll have a hearing where we take testimony on the bill as a whole on different portions of it. So have time for public testimony, time for members to offer amendments and debate those amendments, and then we'll have a vote on the bill as amended. So that's our process. Now that's not that won't be for every single bill. Obviously, there will be bills that the committee needs to vote on to move along that need to go other places and things. But that's kind of our general process. So the bills that we're going to hear today, we're not obviously going to vote on them. We're not going to have any amendments on them. But this is a real hearing in the sense that we won't rehear these bills during session. We're doing this to help manage our load. And so these are bills that might possibly be, we can't do anything official today, but these are bills that we will be, may see again in the omnibus bill. So that's kind of the way we're going today. Any questions on that? Okay, and there'll be opportunities to, you know, for more discussion even on the process. So the first bill up today is my bill, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Moran and go up to the table.
Okay, thank you, Representative Liebling. You can go ahead and present your bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members. So the bill that you have before you is House File 1966, and this is a bill that intends to expand the protections that we give to children in foster care to protect them to the extent practicable from the impact of secondhand smoke. So some of you may know that recently Representative Wagenius had a hearing in her committee about the impact of air pollution. And I don't know that anybody in this committee is on that committee. Oh, good, there are a couple of you. And were you at that hearing? Okay. Well, there was a great deal of testimony from a pediatric lung specialist about asthma. At that time, we were talking about ambient air pollution. But one of the things that also the committee discussed a bit was the impact of indoor air pollution. And I think I wish I could recreate that for you today. I can't. But it was pretty dramatic how much impact there is, particularly on children, from air pollution, especially from tobacco smoke that they may encounter in their homes. Now, as a state, we don't try to tell people what they can and can't do in their own homes. That's a line that we have not yet decided to cross. And some of you may say, good, we never should. But these are what we're talking about today are children who are wards of the state. In a very real sense, they're our children. They're children who've been given to us because they are in some difficulties in their own homes, and the court has placed them in foster care. So when they're in foster care, it's incumbent upon the state to make sure that we do the best that we can to protect their health. I think that it's pretty much beyond doubt now that secondhand smoke has tremendous impacts on health, and I'm not going to go into that any further. But it is really ironic, with all that we've done to protect adults and people in public places and so on from the ravages of secondhand smoke, that we still allow our foster children, who are, again, our children, given to us to protect and raise, and many of them have pre-existing health problems, that we still allow smoking in those homes where they're being, people are being paid to take care of them on behalf of the state. And we know that there is growing consensus around this issue. Half of U.S. states have smoking restrictions for foster homes, and this is a policy that is widely supported. You're going to hear a lot more about that today. So we think that all Minnesota children should have the right to breathe clean air, but foster kids in particular should not be denied that right at the point that they're at their most vulnerable. Often they've survived tragedy, and as I said, often they have bad health conditions to begin with. So that's what this bill attempts to do. It simply adds requirements about clean air to the foster care licensing that goes on already. And just to be clear, if you really look at the bill, it doesn't put, in the situation where there's an emergency and so on, it doesn't stop the child from being placed simply because a person might be unable to provide the best atmosphere with regard to smoking. But it does add having a smoke-free environment to the requirements that these foster care licensing authorities are looking at when they license a home and when they place a child. So with that, I'm going to call on my other testifiers. I'm going to stop talking and let the experts talk. So we have several people to present to you today.
Do we have Molly Molinier?
Okay, I'll stay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Molly Moilanen, and I work for Clearway Minnesota. Our mission is to reduce the harm that tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. I am here to support Chair Liebling's bill on behalf of a large coalition of organizations, including the American Cancer Society, American Lung Association, the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, CenterCare Health Foundation, the Children's Defense Fund, Health Partners, and the Minnesota Medical Association. We share a common mission to reduce Minnesota's exposure to secondhand smoke, especially among children. Kids are more sensitive to the health risks of secondhand smoke, and we need to do more to protect them. Representative Liebling's bill requiring a smoke-free environment for children in foster care is an important and an overdue step. I know that this committee is well aware of the dangers of secondhand smoke, but it's worth reiterating the specific risks posed to children whose bodies are still developing. Now, research tells us that secondhand smoke exposure is a known cause of SIDS, potentially fatal respiratory infections, frequent and severe asthma attacks, and frequent ear infections. Now, adult non-smokers are already protected from secondhand smoke by the Freedom to Breathe Act, and there is absolutely no reason that all of Minnesota kids shouldn't have those same protections. Foster families provide a nurturing and critical care to some of our most vulnerable children, a huge number of who are coming into the foster situations with pre-existing medical conditions. It's our duty to protect their health and safety. We'd like to think of Minnesota as a leader when it comes to healthy kids, but unfortunately, when it comes to protecting children in foster care, we are not. We are behind the times. As Representative Liebling stated, over half U.S. states already have this policy, and a number of counties in Minnesota have already taken actions as well, including Beltrami County, Cottonwood, Jackson, Lake, Steele, Redwood, and St. Louis. And many other counties have efforts well underway. This proposal is hugely popular with the public. 83% of Minnesotans saying they support smoke-free foster care. What's more, these policies enjoy broad support from foster parents in Minnesota, around the U.S. In your packets today, there's a letter of support from Minnesota providers, and our list of supporters is growing every day. Representative Liebling's bill is thoughtful and thorough in the way it addresses this issue. It respects the way Minnesota currently provides foster care. As I said, many U.S. states and many counties in Minnesota have already taken the step, and they provide an excellent case study and will help Minnesota know what to expect from this change. We have seen from their experiences that smoke-free foster care does not affect recruitment and retention, does not affect family placements, and certainly does not impact emergency placements. In your packet, there's a letter of support from Craig Myers, a local health and human service director, fully endorsing his county's smoke-free policy. Today, you have the opportunity to hear from supporters with who represent different points of view, foster care providers, communities of color, and local administrators. And in your packet, there are more testimonials from supporters who wanted to share their stories with you. Finally, in your packet, there is a letter to Representative Liebling from Sarah Weeks. She's a foster care provider from Northfield, Minnesota. As she articulates, we currently require chemicals and toxic substances to be inaccessible to children, but there is no standard about keeping the air free from the chemicals and carcinogens found in cigarette smoke. How can this be? We appreciate the opportunity to advocate for Minnesota's children today, and we also look forward to giving voice to this important issue in the Early Childhood and Youth Development Committee, where this bill was referred to upon introduction. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Pat McComb.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pat McCone. I'm the Director of Tobacco Control Programs and Policy for the American Lung Association of the Upper Midwest. And this is like a dream come true to be able to have this hearing, as I've worked with friends and advocates, staff, and families for over almost 20 years now on this issue. And we're there. And it's not a, it doesn't miss meaning to me that this is the same month that the Surgeon General released the 50-year anniversary of the progress we've made in tobacco control. So thank you. We are the oldest public health organization in the country, over 100 years old, with deep roots in the public health system, first focused on reducing and eliminating tuberculosis. I've worked for the American Lung Association for 35 years, and I'm based out of Duluth. The roads weren't bad coming. Our mission is promotion of lung health and prevention of lung disease. Just want to remind folks that lungs are the last part of the body to develop. We all know that when a baby is born prematurely, that it's about those tiny lungs. Lungs continue to grow for another 8 years, and those first 2 years of life are the most important years in lung development. Nearly 40% of children placed in foster care are born prematurely or with low birth weight. Approximately 80% of these children have at least one chronic medical condition. Life gets complicated really early for these kids. Some of them, nearly one quarter, have three or more chronic conditions, such as diabetes, HIV, and tuberculosis. There are numbers of studies, the most quoted one from California, revealing that these children have three times the rate of asthma. And I don't even want to get into medical costs. I want to talk to this is about children. Children placed in foster care are wards of the state. The state is their legal guardian. The state has an obligation to ensure that they reside in safe and healthy environments. It only seems logical in 2014 and this common sense bill that these foster care homes be smoke-free. The first staff member who brought this forward was actually a foster care parent himself, and I have to mention Steve O'Neill's name because he was a foster care provider for literally dozens of very vulnerable babies. Today, approximately 8,000 children are in foster care in Minnesota, And I was surprised when we first started learning about what it would take to get a state law that to date 25 other states have laws or policies that protect foster care children. I always want to think of Minnesota as leading, so we can catch up really quick. I also want to say and reiterate that some of the first concerns that we were working on this issue had to be with recruiting and retaining foster homes. And we've done research from across the country, and retention and getting foster homes to be smoke-free just is a non-issue. As part of our work at the local issue, we've called literally hundreds of foster care parents asking about their policies and would they support a statewide law. And I can tell you the vast majority of them already have smoke-free homes like we do by rule of the house, and they're very supportive in formalizing this into state law. Any argument about privacy in foster homes is trumped by the best interest of the child. Once again, this common sense bill provides the guidelines and the flexibility for local decision makers to make placements in the best interest of the child. And I want to close with talking about one of my close friends who's worked on this issue. She was is an attorney and at one time a child advocate in Minnesota. When I first approached her on the topic, she was really quite hesitant and candidly said to me, as she recalled the layers of issues and traumas that were involved in the cases that she handled, and quite honestly, she said to me, "I almost feel like this is the least of their problems." But since those initial conversations and her own research on this issue, she has provided me with one of the strongest statements in favor of this common sense legislation. Foster care children are placed in care because of abuse, neglect, abandonment, parental problems such as illness, incarceration, and substance abuse. Placing these uniquely vulnerable children in smoke-filled environments adds insult to injury. On behalf of the American Lung Association and our thousands of supporters, I want to thank you for this opportunity. I also can't end by not mentioning my own family. My sister was developmentally disabled and an adult. She was an adult in a child's body who taught me a lot of life lessons. I had to place her in foster care as an adult. I know this law does not address that yet, but I hope the time comes soon that we also protect those very, very vulnerable loved ones that are considered legally adults. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your testimony. We have Rose Hagi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Rose Hagi, and I have served as a foster parent in Pine and Swift counties. Over the years, I provided foster care to a developmentally disabled individual, as well as a teen mom and her newborn baby. As a foster care provider, I quickly learned that there are many rules foster care homes have to follow in order to get licensed. One of those areas is fire safety. Before my home could be licensed, I was required to install a firewall between my attached garage and my house. And as a foster care provider, I was happy to comply to create a safe and healthy environment for those in my care. However, as someone who has worked in tobacco prevention, it never made sense to me why providing smoke-free environment wasn't on the health and safety checklist in order to become licensed. I lost my husband to lung cancer several years ago when he was 48. That experience has heightened my sensitivity about tobacco use and has made me a passionate advocate for protecting people, particularly children, from the dangers of secondhand smoke. The teen mom that I cared for came to me homeless, pregnant, and extremely vulnerable. I was responsible to model healthy living and healthy choices to her, and I'm really glad I was able to provide a smoke-free environment for her and her baby. She deserved no less, no matter where she had been placed. And I'm here to tell you today that as a former foster care provider, I believe a statewide smoke-free foster care law makes sense. Children in foster care would benefit from it, and as you can see from the letters of support in your packet, There are many foster care providers across Minnesota that want to see this pass. So I hope you will support statewide smoke-free foster care this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jack A.M.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, my name is Jack Aim. I'm part of a fellowship group undergoing training on priority population on how to advocate to reduce the impact of commercial tobacco on in our community. Other members of my group are in the audience today. They're back there. I have been working on smoke-free foster care on the local level in our Ramsey County. It's been easy, but we are making progress. Over the past 4 months, we've been able to secure meetings with decision makers in Ramsey County, and majority are supportive of our initiative. However, they would like to see it adopted at the state level. This is a chance for you to make sure that children in foster care homes in Minnesota is protected from dangers of secondhand smoke. Why protect one child on one side of the river but not the other? I'm also representing those who don't have a voice, our most vulnerable population of children. The number of states that have adopted the law to protect children in foster care from health hazards of secondhand smoke by either prohibiting smoking in foster care homes and or motor vehicles transporting foster children has risen to 26 from 17 in 2012. 8 other states have passed the law, including our next door neighbors, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Iowa. We are a state that leads in protecting our residents from harms caused by secondhand smoke, notably the Freedom to Breathe Act that was passed and signed into law by Governor Pawlenty in 2007. There is a high percentage of children of color in foster care system, and they deserve safe and healthy environment in which to live. I was taken back when I realized that the percentage of children of color in foster care homes is over 50% in Minnesota. Yet the same population or the same community in Minnesota is less than 15%. Now, given that majority of these kids are removed from their homes due to health and security reasons, we feel that their health are still at risk if they are placed in homes that are not free from commercial tobacco. On the other hand, studies have shown that kids raised in smoking environment are more likely to try smoking, eventually adopting smoking. I am here today to ask for your support in protecting our children in foster care for the harm of secondhand smoke. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have.
And thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Judith Brunfield.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judith Brunfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County, and I'm here today representing MACSA, the Minnesota Association of Social Service Administrators, and AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm testifying today in support of this current legislation because we believe it strikes a good balance between children's safety and healthy foster care environments in sections 2 and 3, and we also believe it maintains our flexibility as counties to most appropriately address the individual cases that we see, and that's in section 4, subdivision 9. As someone who deeply cares about our most vulnerable children, and I have spent my entire career in public child welfare services, I can tell you that we do believe providing a safe, healthy environment for children is our top priority. If this legislation were to become law, we would add an additional consideration in our foster care licensing and foster care placement for children. We would welcome the opportunity to look at a smoke-free environment as one of the critical factors for placing children in foster care. However, we do know that these placement decisions are not often black and white issues. And so we have to stress that the flexibility in the current bill is very important to us. There are circumstances which may arise where we will be faced with the difficult choice between a smoke-free, healthy environment and meeting the emotional needs of those children. So this particular piece of legislation in Section 4, Subdivision 9D, allows that kind of flexibility so that the overall consideration has to be the best interest of the children. With this bill, as it's currently being submitted, we would fully support this legislation moving forward and becoming statute in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone from the public who would like to testify? Is there any members with a question? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be to the author of the bill or one of the testifiers, whomever has desire to answer it. On line 4.11 through line 4.13, it discusses a maintenance of a smoke-free environment. I'm just wondering how the author of the bill would respond to the inclusion or consideration of e-cigarettes in contemplation of that definition. Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, that's interesting. Representative Albright, I hadn't thought about it, but while they were testifying, I was thinking, somebody's going to ask about e-cigarettes. And honestly, I haven't really thought about how that would work with this, and I think we're going to deal with that separately. And I think the bills that we have on that would not necessarily impact this. So I think the way this is written, it probably would leave it up to the county to interpret that. That would be my guess right now. Maybe one of the other testifiers would want to comment on that. I mean, I don't think right now under Minnesota law, the vapor from e-cigarettes is defined as secondhand smoke. So probably it's not going to be impacted by this bill, but I'm kind of just speculating here. I haven't really looked into that. It's a very good question. Do any of my testifiers want to comment on that? There you are. So you want to... I'm right? She says I'm right.
Again.
Representative Albright.
I could take a vote back there. Am I right? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then to follow on that same page, going down to lines 4.29 through 4.34, I'm wondering if, I'm specifically looking at line 4.31, it talks about the health risks of exposure to secondhand smoke in contemplation of the e-cigarettes, but then also going to the top of the next page on 5.11, where it says nothing in this subdivision shall delay the placement of child with a relative unless the relative is unable to provide for the immediate health needs of the individual. I'm wondering if there's a conflict that is generated by that, or how the author would remedy that.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I guess I didn't really think of that as a conflict. I think the idea is to give the counties the flexibility that you heard about here, because the overriding interest is the best interest of the child. So, for example, it may be that a child has, we know that a child's emotional needs are very important too. So say that the the most appropriate person in a critical situation for a child is a relative, but that relative is a smoker. Well, the county may determine that that is the place the child needs to be, notwithstanding that the person is a smoker. Or I would say, I'm interpreting this, unable to provide for immediate health needs. For example, if a child has very bad asthma and can't be around cigarette smoke, that might then override the decision to place with a relative if that person can't keep the smoke out of the house. So I think it's just a flexibility for the counties to make that on an individual basis. But please. I'm sorry,
Mrs. Brumfield.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly what we are talking about. An example would be sometimes we have, let's say, a 10 or 12-year-old child who has lived with grandparents and then returned home to parents and has to go into placement. These grandparents are not already licensed as foster parents, but in order for the county to make that placement, we need to go through a licensing process with them. This statute would then apply. But if those grandparents absolutely at that point refuse to have a smoke-free environment, we're left with the decision of, is it in the best interest for that child to be with the grandparents that they know and feel secure and loved by, or go to a stranger foster home? We'd like to at that point be able to make the decision based on the best interest of the child, perhaps make that placement, and then work with those grandparents to look at having a smoke-free environment, but not to have that as a ban to making that placement. So while we believe it's very important to have the smoke-free environment, there might be times when it really is in the best interest of the child to make that placement and then take the time to work toward achieving the smoke-free environment.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. And this would be for the testifier, Madam Chair. Then in terms of a hierarchy of prioritization of the elements of a placement, then, and I'm not trying to pigeonhole you or to ask for a hard and fast rule, but where would you place a smoke-free environment on the hierarchy of placement requirements for a foster home, Madam Chair?
Mrs. Brumfield.
Madam Chair, Representative, that depends. If it's a stranger placement, if we're placing a child in a foster home for the first time for them where they don't know the person, then it's primary. The health of a child is primary at that point. And so you're looking at foster parents who have already gone through a licensing process, who know this is a requirement. And so for me, that would be almost an absolute. If you are looking at a relative, then you're going to balance the child being able to be with a family as opposed to having the purity of a smoke-free environment and maybe taking a little more time. Now, if that child is a very young child, then because of lung development, the smoke-free environment becomes even more important. If it's an older child who has an established relationship with that relative who's going through the trauma of placement, then you look at the emotional needs. So the best answer I can give you is it depends. It's incredibly important, but you really, each child, you have to look at their own circumstances.
Representative Albright?
Just one final question then. In terms of if the foster child is placed in a foster home, and I'm just wondering to the extent or the policy in terms of guests or visitors to that home, would the obligation be the same for those that enter the house or where the foster parents take the foster child? Would the same obligation for a smoke-free environment be required of that family wherever they take the child to another, say, another relative's home, or as relatives come to visit that foster home, would they be obligated to, let's just say, you know, don't smoke in the house, but, you know, go to the furthest, you know, boundary line and that's your smoking zone? Or what obligation does the foster family have when visitors arrive that might presumably smoke? What provision is there for that?
Mrs. Brumfield.
Madam Chair, my interpretation of this as also the licensing agent is that the expectation for the smoke-free environment would be an obligation that the foster parent would have no matter who came into their home, so that they would be expected, if they have guests in their home, that it remain a smoke-free environment for those guests. The obligation, if they are taking the child to visit, again, is to the best of their ability to maintain that smoke-free environment. Mm-hmm. I think there are some limitations. We would not be We would not remove a child, for example, simply because they went to visit someone who smoked in their home.
Thank you,
again,
Ms. Chair.
With the expectation, if that was a particular health issue for that child, like you will not take a child who has asthma to a home where someone smokes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lomar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. I appreciate what you're trying to do here, but what comes to mind for me is I'm not really even sure the answer to this question as far as if we have a shortage or not of foster homes or whatever, but I guess my question is, has anybody looked at how many people are currently smoking right now that this will affect, and how many foster homes might we lose with this bill going into effect? Has anybody looked at that issue?
Well, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lomer, I don't know the numbers. Maybe I'm sure somebody else here will know those numbers, but one of the things that we did discuss in putting together this bill was that issue of will we lose foster homes, because we know that, you know, we all just know that there are never enough foster homes, right? But I don't know if you maybe came in a little bit late, but there was testimony that this has been looked at and studied, and the impact on losing foster homes is pretty negligible. So that's why I think the counties are supporting the bill. If they were going to lose a bunch of foster homes, I don't think they'd be here supporting the bill, because that is a big concern. As far as how many smoke, I first filed this bill because I was contacted by a foster provider who was appalled to see that other children, not in her own home, but that there were children who were being exposed to secondhand smoke. I think the numbers aren't huge, and I think they are diminishing. But that said, you know, I think one child is too many. And so maybe somebody has the actual numbers.
Mrs. Brumfield?
Madam Chair, I do not have the actual numbers. I do know that very few of our foster parents smoke. They recognize that that's a health hazard. We don't see it as a major problem to deal with those who do smoke. Again, the flexibility is there for us to develop a plan with them so that they would stop smoking. We do find there are all sorts of requirements for foster parents that they are used to complying with those requirements. So this becomes another one, and then you work through how that happens. Again, part of the flexibility of this is we would not have to remove a child who is living in a foster home where they currently were smoking. We would be obligated to work with those foster parents to try and provide a smoke-free environment.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this is a policy direction that we definitely should be going. I'm just wondering, I've watched as different campuses or businesses have gone smoke-free on their full campus, that they've typically, you know, accompanied that with some kind of a transition plan where they offer or promote access to Clearway and other, you know, smoking cessation programs, or offered guidance as a, on how to do this. And I'm wondering if you have talked with the partners that you've engaged with on maybe similar sort of a transition plan for existing foster parents and maybe even new ones who might step forward but might need some help to transition to that type of a lifestyle in their own home.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, you know, that has been a specific conversation, but I think that I'm not too concerned about it because of a couple of things. One is that there is the flexibility in the bill. Another is that we're talking about foster families who, as our testifier said, are used to working with having conditions in the home. So I think it's not a, and that things are kind of moving this way already. So I don't think people are going to be really shocked by this. I think it's something that a lot of foster families probably know is kind of coming. But also there are resources that are available to everyone. Quit plan and other things, and I wouldn't be surprised if the counties also had plans or would develop plans as they work with these families. I'm not sure what that would mean in every case, but there are resources available to help people stop smoking or just to get them to smoke separately from where the children are.
Did
Did you want to add anything, Mrs. Brumfield?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, we would certainly be looking at those kinds of options. We would work with the foster parents. We would never want to lose a good foster parent over this. On the other hand, this might be that last push they would need to make a change in their lifestyle that they know would be healthy for them. So we would certainly work with them, and there are a number of options that we could use to help them with a plan.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Oh, thanks. And if you wait long enough for a question, half of them get answered, so I'll be quicker. I remember the whole smoking debate. It was 2007, and I was squarely on both sides. at the time, I remember the discussion, and I saw a lot of reason in it, and I can see some of the value of this. And I would be interested to know if, like, what percentage are really going to be affected, if it's 5%, or there must be somebody, and you don't know the answer, but that's the advantage of having a bill up early. No opponents came forward. Are there people who are going to say that this is a problem and realize you couldn't have gotten to all your foster care providers to let them know this is coming up? But it would just be interesting to hear the point of view of somebody who didn't like this. I remember well the discussion and the debate and about the smoking stuff, and some of the same topics occur, and you know, all the chemicals and all that, and I'm good with that part. So I just would be nice to know as we move forward and fence somebody out of where they were doing really good work, and maybe that they would be allowed to testify. But I also want to make sure that this really does give the options to the county that you think you're giving them. Because I've been here 15 years now, it's my 16th year, you write language that you think is clear and what you intend, and then later they go by the words. Now the AMPLATs carve out on the not having to get the reduction in the children's hospital. I thought that was fully clear in our spreadsheets and our discussion that there were four places, not three. And upon further review, the words didn't match up. It was one of my rookie mistakes as a chair to not read every word as carefully as I might have. It's my responsibility. But just so you know what you're really doing, and so that the county really has flexibility, and if you get a person who has a particular just real concern about this as being the key element, and then you lose somebody who is really good but for the fact they smoke rarely in their home, you'd hate to lose that. So that's just my, I guess it's a comment. You can respond if you want.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brumfield, overall statistics are somewhat meaningless. And I guess my point is, in talking to some of the communities of color, there's a real problem in getting foster parents of the same background as the child. And so a general statement that, you know, it's only going to affect 5% or whatever, unless you have statistics as to each location in Minnesota and how it will affect those communities, I'm quite concerned, because there is a strong feeling of wanting that connection. And so I hope as this proceeds, we will have statistics on that issue, because it is a concern to me as it is to those communities.
Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, let me first respond to that, and then I'll respond to Representative Abler a little bit. I don't have the numbers, but I think that the bill, if you read the entire bill and go through all the language that's the existing language in the statute, there's a lot about, you know, making sure children have, are with culturally similar families when possible, kind of protecting their cultures and so on. So I think that's already something that really runs through the existing law pretty strongly. I think that together with the flexibility in the statute, in this bill, for the counties to be able to place children in their best interests is kind of protective against that. I mean, I would worry, too, if I thought that all of the families of color that were foster families are going to suddenly not be able to be foster families because of the requirement that they not smoke. I mean, of course, we want our kids of color to have a smoke-free environment, too. So I think that this is, you know, and many of them also, we know, are disproportionately affected by asthma, as a matter of fact, possibly because of they tend to live in more air pollution. So with so many of the children in the foster system being children of color, as one of our testifiers talked about, I think this is especially important for them. The other thing I wanted to just say in response to Representative Abler, I had filed this bill last session, and at that time there was quite a bit of publicity around it, and I don't recall one opponent contacting me. Not one. It's really been out there quite a while. And, of course, we're not voting on it today. There's still time to hear if anybody is opposed to it. But I think that, as was stated, even people who are actually smoking most of the time realize that it's not a healthy thing to do, and they may be not that unhappy to have a little extra push to make sure that the kids are protected. Kind of another, you know, another thing to make them say, well, at least I won't smoke in the house when there are children present and stuff like that. So I think we're not hearing from opponents because if there's always opponents to everything, but I think that this has had pretty broad acceptance, and certainly all the media around it has been very positive.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Liebling, I looked at the bill, and I understand there are other considerations, but Ms. Brownfield said on a stranger adoption this would be the issue. And so many people of color adoptions are stranger, not just relatives. So that's my concern on that.
I just want to quickly just point out that this is not about adoptions. This is just...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, in foster care.
In foster care, but...
Okay.
It's raised, as you know, it's raised by the community on both issues.
Okay.
And thank you for pointing my mistake and wording.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Zuras.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And to Representative Liebling, question a little bit about kind of the wording here. You know, it's kind of presented as a secondhand smoke bill, and it lists throughout different parts of the bill talk about areas where you may be exposed to secondhand smoke. And if you look at starting at 4.21, a child in foster care shall not be exposed any type of secondhand smoke in the following settings, and then licensed foster home, any space connected to the home, garage, porch, deck, outhouse, pretty much anywhere around there, can't smoke. If all outdoors on the premises of the home when a foster child is present, can't smoke, that's secondhand smoke. But then 4.26 is worded different, and it says a motor vehicle in which a foster child is transported. Does that mean if a foster family, a foster parent has one vehicle, they smoke in that vehicle, but then transport the child and don't smoke when they're transporting the child? Are they in violation of that number three? Because my reading makes me think they are, and so I'm kind of wondering about that. So I think we're, because now we're talking about third-hand smoke, not first-hand smoke, not second-hand smoke, but you smoked over this upholstery last week. We got to make sure you can't have a foster child. So I think that might be, we might be going out a bit. So I'm curious on your thoughts.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Zuras. I mean, of course, the great thing about this process we have is that you get to improve on your language and so on. And I do see that there is some ambiguity there. Of course, it's not the intention to say that there could no one could ever smoke in a car in which a foster child is later transported. So I think we could definitely clarify that wording to make that clear.
Okay.
Representative Zuras.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I guess it's just a general comment. You know, I understand where we're going here, and I understand the direction that this is going. I tend to think some of the language is a bit much. if you have someone that wants to take care of a child, that the child might be in a particularly difficult part of their upbringing, and you have someone that honestly cares for children and wants to take care of them, if we don't want them to smoke in the house, then say, don't smoke in the house. If you don't want to smoke next to the foster child, say, don't smoke next to the foster child. But they can't step out on their porch. They can't step out on their deck. If it's 23 below, they can't go into their garage. I mean, if we're at a point where we're going to make smoking illegal, write the legislation, introduce it. But I think I can see where you're trying to go in some of this, but I think at some point it just goes way too far.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Sirwas, I think you're over-reading it a little bit. It says a child in foster care shall not be exposed to any type of secondhand smoke in the following settings. It doesn't say anywhere that a person can't step out on their deck, to smoke when the child isn't present. But also, this isn't a bill that yanks a child away from a foster family if they make a little transgression. It really just gives counties the flexibility to add that as any other hazard. I mean, I don't know all of the things that they're required to check, but for example, if you have a toddler in a foster home, I'm sure you're not allowed to leave, buckets of soapy water sitting open where the child could fall in. It just kind of makes sense. Well, if somebody did something one time that, the county would have to evaluate whether that meant that they couldn't safely care for a child. I just don't think it's, kind of a drop dead, you're going to be penalized kind of thing here.
Representative Zerwas.
No, and I appreciate that, Representative Liebling, and I think as I look through this, as Representative Abler pointed out, the words matter. And so I think exposed is, I think, a pretty broad term. And it says in the following settings. And it talks about a home, a space connected to the home, including garage, porch, deck, or similar space. Then if that all meant whether a child was or was not present, on line 4.25, I don't think you'd have to specify that only counts when the child is present. And then on 4.26, it doesn't talk about that, but you said that was right, that was confusing. And so if 4.26 is confusing, then clearly 4.23 means the same. So I think there's a lot of areas that we can address the language on what we're really trying to do with this piece of legislation. And I think furthermore, we have counties that, and I understand AMC is here supporting this, but we have counties and we're consistently putting more and more rules and saying, check for this, go back and check for that, monitor for this, and I think that's a concern too. And so I think it behooves us to clean up the language so that as our county workers are going back and you see an ashtray on the front porch, I mean, does that mean that the person is violating this, or does that not mean the person's violating this? And so I think there's an opportunity to get this a little bit clearer and hopefully not provide such a burden to our counties doing follow-up.
Mrs. Bromfield.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, let me address a couple of those. And I guess to get back to one of Representative Abler's concerns as well, this is not new legislation for us. It's been coming forward for some time, and we have been able to talk to the author as counties over the last year. We really have worked very closely with the language to try and make sure that it did provide the flexibility that we needed, while at the same time having a very clear policy implication about wanting to have a healthy environment for children. So we are confident in the language allowing enough flexibility. But we also were very clear that it's in the statute that deals with where the children will be living as opposed to the statute that is licensing. So we share your concern about additional mandates on the counties that are rules that we have to oversee. So this really isn't about the licensing statute, it's about the placing statute. So it doesn't mean the county has to go out and inspect the home to check for whether or not they're smoking. It's an expectation that they have a smoke-free environment, and we look at that in terms of placing a child. So it is a different balance for what the county is expected to do in this circumstance.
Thank you. Yeah, and so, Chair, if I could just real quickly, too. And also, I just want to say, Representative Zerwas, I appreciate that you're pointing out some of the lack of clarity about this. It would be very easy to fix that. And so, you know, I appreciate your... obviously, we're not going to wordsmith it right here in committee. We don't need to because we're not voting on the bill today, but... you know, certainly take a look at that language so that if the bill comes forward, we can tighten it up a little bit.
Thank you. So we have two more speakers here, Representative Stone and also Representative Francis. After Representative Franson, we would need to move on because we have two other bills to hear. And again, we're not going to vote on this bill. It's going to be laid over. Representative Stone.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. You already answered my questions because I've seen you feverishly taking notes on that clarity language. I'm for the bill. Thank you for offering to clean it up because I know you always will and you're always open to that. And I love children.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, you know, Representative Zerwas actually did an excellent job of communicating what I wanted to do. But, you know, I was in a foster home. From the time I was 6 months until I was two, I do not know if those foster care parents smoked or not, but during that time, you know, my dad was working on getting custody of me, and my dad still smokes to this day, as did my stepmom during that time. So I really would hope that this bill would not impede on any reunification with parents, because, I mean, I don't know where I'd be if I was stuck in the system until I graduated because my parents were smoking. And yet this is, you know, I understand your intention, Representative Liebling, but in my opinion, this is just another bill of government making decisions for our children instead of the other way around. And we all know where I stand on those issues of government. So thank you.
And I just, I think that was the last question, right, Madam Chair? And so let me just sort of address that again as I did at the beginning, and I think Representative Franson maybe wasn't here. You know, foster children are really different because we are taking care of these children. We as a state are taking care of these children. They are in our custody. So I think we have a special duty. We do set the rules for them. We do. We set all kinds of rules. So the counties are in the position of deciding what family they're going to be with. So as you heard, this is about making a placement decision where it's going to be best for the child. It has nothing to do with reunification with families. It doesn't impact that at all. It simply says, among the health and safety issues that we look at when we're deciding whether to place a child with a certain family, is going to be whether they can provide a smoke-free atmosphere for the child. And as you might have heard her say, and for you know, if there are not other considerations, that's going to be a very important one. If it's a matter of are they going to be with a relative or not, and it's important for them to be with a relative that they're close to in the foster placement, then that's going to supersede, because really it's about the best interest of the child. But this is not something that should get us into that argument about whether we're being a nanny state, because we are the nanny in a very real sense. This is our job in this very limited place. These are children. They've been removed from their families, and they are in our care. And if we don't set the rules for them to be in healthy and safe care, then, you know, that is a very, very sad statement. I mean, this is one of our basic responsibilities as a state. So I appreciate your concern, but we have to sort of keep in mind that this bill is very limited in its scope, and it's aimed at children that we are setting the safety standards for them. Thank you. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Great day in America.
Okay, we're going to move on now, and if we could ask the folks that are leaving, just please try to do so quietly so we can continue. We have a couple bills to get through here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Abler. You have 1347.
Right, Madam Chair. Actually, people leaving should say these bills are even more interesting than the last bills that we had, and if these bills can pass, the world will be a better place. And so they're kind of on the same... they're on similar topics, and they have to do with vendors trying to stay in business serving our people on medical assistance. And as you're aware, with the rate setting and some of the reductions over the past, some of the margins that these vendors have to work with are extremely lean, and so we're trying to keep them so they want to keep serving our clients. And we have a lot of witnesses, or at least we have ample witnesses to testify about the specifics of the two, so I'll just let them get to it, and then I think you'll see some overlap in the two bills, Madam Chair, so I'll just turn it over to my witnesses.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Susan Wingert. I happen to represent the Minnesota Midwest Association for Medical Equipment and Suppliers Providers. I also come to you today as a business owner. As Dr. Abler alluded to, Representative Abler alluded to, we have had a number of cuts in our reimbursement. As a matter of fact, we've had cuts for the last 12 years. One of the things as a business owner that is hard for me to do is to plan on how I am going to invest in not only my company, but in the people that serve the population called Minnesota Medical Assistance. Periodically, when bills come, we, of course, in the industry, spend a lot of time investigating and looking to see what impact it has on us. And one of the problems that we have experienced over the last few years is the fact, and although this may sound cynical, it is indeed a thought that happens in our industry, that when there is a cut and a provider group is called out, it really doesn't matter what provider group is called out, we always seem to belong to that one. So if it's basic care and that gets cut, we happen to be basic care, and so we take a reduction in reimbursement. If it happens to be non-acute, non-hospital care, which is different, we believe, than basic care, we belong in that one. And so as a business owner, trying to understand what kind of reimbursement and ability that I have to invest in my business, I need somebody in the legislature to help us define where do we belong. And then leave us there. I have talked to folks in the Senate and in the House of Representatives and said, you know, help me understand why you cut us. And one of the first things they said is, oh, we cut you? Oh, we didn't know you belonged in that group. Well, that would now be two of us that didn't know we belonged in that group. So what I'm here today to do is to ask only for this. Put us someplace. If you want to make us non-acute, non-hospital, we're delighted with that. If for some reason you prefer to say basic care, we'll go along with that too. We just want to be in one group, and we want to stay there. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. And would you like to testify?
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Anderson. I also am a member of the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers and represent a family-owned business that struggles with the same issues that my colleague has articulated. Our bill, just to clarify, with the definition of durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, and supplies, the DME POS language that we put in there comes from Medicare, and that is a governing statute that Medicare's benefit categories defines the services that we provide in that way, and so I just wanted to clarify for the committee that that is why we have used that term as a suggestion.
Okay. And so any questions from members? Yeah, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question would go to the testifier, but if Dr. Abler wants to.
Madam Chair, it's good to be back. And I'm not sure if this affects e-cigarettes or not, if they're considered they're purchased as a durable medical good.
Dr. Abler, we could spin a yarn here if we wanted to.
Well, they are durable.
Okay. You mentioned in the language that you wish not to be included in basic care services. So under the categories that are most applicable to durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, and supplies, what category is the best fit?
Madam Chair, Representative. A definition all of its own. And that would be the definition that Medicare provides, which is durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, and supplies. So when you are looking at a provider type, you call it out specifically. The example might be ambulance services. That is a specific service that is called out by that definition. And we would like to be looked at in that same fashion. The non-acute, non-hospital care is also an appropriate definition. We take care of chronically ill patients. We do not take care of acute patients. An acute patient may be somebody that has a strep throat that goes in to see a physician. We take care of the patients that have issues that are going to last, in some cases, a lifetime. And so either one of those definitions would work for us.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then the question begets asking, under the definitions for, let's say, durable medical equipment, would that include beds and CPAP or not CPAP? Or what's included in a definition of durable medical? Is there a workaround that can be avoided or disavowed for repayment if you don't meet that definition?
At this point, durable medical equipment simply means medical equipment that is supplied that has a lifetime to it. Typically speaking, that lifetime is about 5 years. It runs the gamut from things such as a commode to a life-saving device called a ventilator. And all of those things are in between. Most of those things are defined by HCPCS codes. And so there is a list that is substantial, and it certainly is available both by the state of Minnesota and by the Medicare that clearly calls out what those pieces of equipment are. You mentioned beds and CPAPs. They would both fall under that category. What might not fall under that category would be things like e-cigarettes.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair. For the doctor, then. In your language, then, why wouldn't it make sense to, rather than exclude these services from a category, would you not want to then include the specific category that they best fit in?
We could certainly do that.
Ms. Winger, please go through the chair.
Oh, excuse me. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, we certainly could do that.
And is that something that the doctor would be amenable to in terms of future legislation?
Okay, we could ask him. Dr. Abler?
Pursuant.
Madam Chair, I love interim hearings. This is great to be back. And just so you know, that'd be a great idea. And we can, sure. Part of the benefit of this has been, this bill's been laying around for some time, too. It's a little dusty, frankly, I could say. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is when, in 2011 and other years, we've made some reductions in different rates. And we think we mean something in what we're including, and sometimes things are picked up by accident. But we'd still have the authority to reduce rates or raise rates for this particular group. At least we would know what we're doing and it'd be clear. So I think that, again, my good colleague, Representative Albright, has landed on a good idea about improving even a bill to make it even better. And I think that maybe the time has come to clarify what category this stuff should be in. And there may or may not be a fiscal note tied to that change, but we could... You know, if they're without a fiscal note, you would just clarify what it is now and have its own category. And you would, if you took away some cuts and put it back to the old historic rate, then that would have a fiscal cost. So I think this bill will be making a trip to another committee anyway. So,
right. So actually, I wanted to ask staff if I don't know who would have drafted this or if any of you did, but maybe do any of the staff want to comment on whether this is properly drafted or whether it makes any difference which category we put this stuff in, if you know, Mr. Chun?
Madam Chair and members, I think that the bill as drafted, you know, it isn't specific as to what category it goes on. I think you could possibly read it as implying that it is a separate category of DME and POS together. But I think if there's agreement on a specific category, it may be cleaner to draft the bill that way.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we'll work.
Representative Abler. Okay, great. Right. Okay, great. We'll move on then. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So your next bill, House File 1348.
Madam Chair, it's a related topic, and I don't know how much you're going to get into spend downs, and I know Ms. Henry's going to testify, which is I encourage her to do that. The challenge, again, is that these companies have a lot of hard costs, and some people have to take income they have that's over the income limit and spend it on qualified things to get into medical assistance. And so in the health plans, that's already built into their coverage, and they have to give the money, I think, to the health plan to spend on, or at least it has to be documented. And the fee-for-service, that's not the case. And so these individuals may actually sell someone, I guess not e-cigarettes, but other things that they might be selling. I love you, man. But they would be selling them a bed or whatever, CPAP or whatever, and actually until they get that spend on money, they're actually losing money on the transaction. And so there is some challenge. The county has talked about a concern about workload, and you'll hear from Ms. Henry about just the burden on the individual. But if we're not careful and solve this in some way, we'll have individuals who their card on fee-for-service will not be honored by people who don't have to lose, aren't willing to lose money on a product. And so that's the other side of the thing as we try to solve this problem. This bill is an attempt to solve it in a certain way. There may be, again, a better way. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Al Newman. I'm current state chair for MAMES. Again, we provide medical equipment and supplies across the state of Minnesota, representing 40-some companies. This is a very difficult situation for business owners because we don't find out about this situation until 4 to 6 weeks post-delivery. Could be oxygen, could be a bed, could be a nebulizer, could be repairs to a power wheelchair that keeps people active in their community. We simply don't get paid for that until their spend down is met. And so it could be months of rental on a piece of equipment, could be enteral products, feeding that is necessary for them to remain in their homes. And we absorb that cost. We cannot, the individual has an option to pay that to the state. They never do. They don't pay us either. Less than 5% is collected because it's a state law that we cannot turn these people or do any collection efforts. They're the poorest people in the state, so they don't have any money anyway. I look as a business owner that this issue is basically another way just to reduce our reimbursement. As a taxpayer, I ask you, and as a caregiver myself, why do I have a disproportionate share of the cost of keeping these individuals in their home? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Anderson, did you want to testify on this as well?
No, but I'll be available for additional questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions, members? Oh, yeah, questions to these folks, and then Ann Henry is going to testify as well. But as long as we have these folks. So everybody understands what the issue is here that we're talking about? Okay. All right. So Ann Henry will come and talk to us, and then... So please just be available and see if there are questions at the end. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. And you're getting a handout of a chart about the income that we're talking about. And first, I want to say that we absolutely support providers getting paid for the services they're providing to our vulnerable clients. That's not a question. I think the issue is, can you get blood from a turnip? Because the people that we're talking about are living at 75% of the poverty level if they pay the medical bills. And that means today, $719 a month. So you can imagine that somebody who might have $900 to live on would find it difficult to pay $150 or $200 or even $5 for health care, especially with the winter that we're having here. So I really wanted to suggest that a better solution to the problem is actually a bill that Representative Loeffler has, House File 1039. We did have a hearing in this committee last year, and it would raise that spend down level up. And I just want to call your attention to this chart. The Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities is in strong support of raising this income standard. You'll notice now that on medical assistance, every other group is higher than the elderly and disabled group, January 1st, 2014. The percent of poverty, the lowest percent of poverty now for folks is 138. That's, you'll see it as 133 plus 5% income disregard. We just put 138 on the chart. But for people who are elderly, in other words, over 60 or 65 or over, or certified as having a long-term permanent disability, they either have to have no more than 100% of the poverty level, but if they have $1 more than $958 a month, they have to spend down to $719 a month. And that is why we have problems with providers getting paid. So the recommendation that we have is to really urge equity for this group, for the low-income seniors and people with disabilities, and at least get them up to the next lowest level for everybody else on medical assistance. The bill last year was amended given cost considerations to move up the spend down level in three steps. And the legislature has taken sort of a step approach to this in the past during the 90s. But at any rate, I really wanted to take the opportunity to draw your attention to really why this is a problem. It's a problem because these folks just have so little money, and yet our state policy and what folks want is to live as independently as possible in the community. So in order to do that, people are just really having to struggle very hard. Plus, it's also necessary for them to qualify for all kinds of other benefits, which have different eligibility requirements, administrative costs, and so on. The money that we're taking away from people because of their health care needs in order to qualify for medical assistance is usually their Social Security. And if we could let them have their Social Security to live on, I think they would have continuous coverage, so providers would get paid, and they would need a lot less of other kinds of assistance, and more of them could remain in their own homes and get that new refrigerator if it breaks down, or fix the roof, or whatever it is. So that's really why I wanted to testify today. I think there is a better, more comprehensive solution to this significant problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Bob, please stay there. I've got Representative Schoen. I'm not sure who his question is to. So.
Well, Madam Chair, and maybe Ms. Henry, anybody can answer this, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I heard what I thought I heard, is that we have a system in place where we have the poorest people that need these devices, that if they make a dollar over a limit, we make them spend $200 of their own money in order to get back to a place where they can get reimbursed, or we... I mean, and I know I'm new to this by a year, but that just seems, I don't know what the term I want to use for it. I don't think I can say it out loud, but wrong is for sure. Did I heard that correctly, right, yep. Madam Chair?
That's my understanding, Representative Schoen, and I think that this bill really kind of puts a spotlight on that, and thank you, Ms. Henry, for coming to talk about that. Did you want to follow up?
Well, a technical term maybe is, that's really stupid.
Yeah, that's a good technical
term.
All
right, sorry.
So I wanted to ask Ms. Henry, and then I'll get to Representative Grunhagen. So just looking at your chart, and thanks for bringing this, is this, when we're talking about these spend downs, the only group we're talking about is the group who are in this situation now that is on your chart, correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Those are the folks that have this spend down. There could be perhaps some other people who had a catastrophic occurrence, say a parent that would need to qualify for medical assistance and had some extraordinary cost. I mean, it remains to be seen how many people get coverage and how long that takes. But there could be someone else. But the group of people that we're really talking about are people who are seniors and people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Representative Grunstein.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. No, just an observation following Representative Schoen's comment. I find myself in agreement with him. But it's the same philosophy that's in Obamacare. If you earn like $1 over certain levels, the IRS is going to come after you and claw that back the year after. So I would agree it's stupid, and stupid is as stupid does, and it's the same philosophy in Obamacare. Thank you.
You used my name.
Oh, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was with you all the way up until the other part, which I'm pretty sure you know what I'm referring to.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, if we could, let's please stick to the bill.
This would pertain to either the current testifier or to Representative Abler. I just need clarification. If we do either 1348 or the 1039, which was the Loeffler bill from last year, exclude Social Security payments from consideration when looking at the medical assistance.
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, no, they don't exclude that. In the Medicaid program, that your Social Security is considered income. It's a broad definition of income, and so this would be under federal law, and because the Medicaid program is a partnership of federal and state funding, we have to follow the federal law in order to qualify for the federal match. So Social Security is considered income in terms of having to spend down and qualify for coverage.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it would seem to me that in this day and age, is it possible to request a waiver for the state to enact medical assistance that is more attractive and or conducive to the way that we want to treat our most vulnerable in consideration of what the federal government does?
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I think that it may be possible to do that, but that we're perfectly free in every state to raise this income standard so that people's income could remain with them rather than having to be spent down on medical bills to qualify for coverage. And let me just draw this out a little bit more to show you how I didn't go back and look at when the spend down idea came into our laws, but it certainly was a long time ago, and I think it's so inconsistent today with how we look at health coverage and insurance, because every month if you're on a spend down, you aren't covered until you incur whatever your spend down is, $200. Let's say you have 100, you know, just over 100% of the poverty level, so you've got, you know, $960 a month to live on your Social Security check. Well, you're not covered for your health care costs until you incur down to $719 a month. So people are either on and off all the time. And it, you know, we know churning is expensive and it's bad for your health, on and on. So it really, the step that I think that it would be the wisest step for our state to take is to raise that at least up to the lowest other level for everyone else, and we would almost double people's amount of money that they could live on at that point.
Okay. And Mr. Newman, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just want to reel this back in and say, yeah, they incur their costs, but they never pay us. Okay, so the point of our whole bill is somehow to get reimbursement, whether the state does that or not. If they want to go on to another carrier besides the state of Minnesota, they have to pay the state that excess money. Otherwise, if they refuse to do that, they drop down into this category. And again, we're looking at kind of a circle effect here. It's the providers that take the brunt of this. And it's not just us. It's the docs. It's nursing. It's everybody providing services to this group. So two-pronged approach. But number one is fix our issue. Eliminate the choice. If they have a spend down, if it's a dollar, they got to spend a dollar. I think they got to modify that dollar amount. I can't seem to spend a $200 down out of a $900 income. But I'm just saying we need to get paid if we want to continue keeping these people out of hospitals, out of facilities, and in their homes. And again, I thank you too. I really get it, and that added a lot of light. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and Representative Abler is going to get the final word on this.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, this actually is a good discussion. I thought it was federal, but it's a state law about this 175% matter. And with the increase in the expansion of the Medicaid group, it's actually exacerbated this. And so if you're simply poor, you're treated at an advantage to someone who's elderly and disabled. It came up in discussions with one of my good colleagues in the Senate as a way to try to fix it, but there wasn't willingness last year to work on that. And I think maybe this kind of situation gives people an incentive to do it. There is a fiscal note to do that, to actually deal with the spend that I don't. And perhaps we can redo have an amendment that will undo the spend down so we can get a fiscal note and see what people are talking about for money. But in terms of our treatment of the elderly and disabled, it's the whole room thinks that's an important group to deal with. There's no partisan divide on that. So I'm glad this came forward. I hope at the end of the day there's some way to give relief to these vendors, because I want to warn us as policymakers and the people listening, the day is going to come when your card issued by the state that says some state program on it will be valueless at certain vendors, and you have a card that does nothing. And that's no one intended that. So thank you for the good discussion, members, and Madam Chair, for giving me two bills today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And just so members know, too, this whole issue about different programs having different requirements and eligibility, and there is a big initiative that you will be hearing this session from Department of Human Services to try to deal with and align some programs to try to at least make things a little bit more administratively simple. So there is some of that coming, and thank you, Representative Abler. Thank you, testifiers. So there's another committee coming right in here, so thank you for attending today, members. We are adjourned.